We're just making assumptions that it's better to put babies in prison than to put their mothers in community. But we don't have any evidence to prove that.
Hello, and welcome to the Children of Incarcerated Caregivers International Prison Nursery Podcast. My name is Barbara Fry, and I'm an advisory board member of the Children of Incarcerated Caregiver, or CIC's, board, and the former director of the University of Minnesota's Human Rights Program. Today, we are joined by Dr. Martha Painter. Dr. Painter is director of nursing research with the contraception and abortion research team at the University of British Columbia and assistant professor in the Faculty of Nursing at the University of New Brunswick. Her clinical teaching and research focus on the intersection of reproductive health and the criminal justice system in Canada. She is the affiliate scientist for the ROSE Clinic, which stands for Reproductive Options and Services, and the founder, director of research, and past chair of Wellness Within, an organization for health and justice, the only organization in Canada dedicated to advancing reproductive justice for people in the carceral system. Welcome, Dr. Painter.
Thanks for having me, Barbara.
I'm very interested in learning about, especially about the situation facing incarcerated mothers and children in Canada. And we're so grateful to you for sharing your time and your expertise on that topic. Let's start really with your research in regard to mothers and children and in Canada's prison system. What aspects of reproductive justice in the carceral system sparked your interest?
I first became involved in this work back in 2012. There was a very horrific case that happened at the Ottawa Carlton Detention Center, which is a remand and provincial jail in Ottawa, Canada's capital. And in September of 2012, a young woman named Julie Belota was 8 months pregnant, her first pregnancy, and she went into labor in that jail. She was denied care. She was sent to solitary confinement for crying out in pain. She was denied medication. When a little foot was seen pushing out of her vulva, she was accused of shoving contraband up herself. And the baby, in the end, was born footling breech in a jail cell. At the time, I was working with doulas and other reproductive justice advocates, in particular advocates for abortion access, in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And we realized at that time, as doulas who were doing a lot of volunteer work with a single parent center, that we actually didn't know what was happening inside the carceral systems that were, you know, a couple of kilometers from where we were located. And so that began this odyssey, really, of getting inside the first the provincial and then the federal as well as youth sites to witness, bear witness to what was happening, to offer companionship. And then once we were inside, we realized there was really shockingly little known about what happened to these women and their children, really a major gap in the research literature. And that shifted a direction in my work in reproductive health to develop a research program that looked at this intersection.
Interesting. What a case. Wow. Well, first, before we get into the details, could you give us a profile of incarcerated mothers across the system? How, in general, how many women are incarcerated in Canada, and what are the demographics and criminal charges, and how many of them have children?
So across Canada, we have two major systems, the federal system, which is where you have been convicted and sentenced to 2 years or more. There are six federal prisons for women, and on a given day, a total of not more than 700 women in that system across the entire country. I know that that number seems very small compared to U.S. mass incarceration numbers, but Canada has a very small population and actually is on the higher end of incarceration rates for the Western world. Within our provincial system, there are two types of people experiencing incarceration: people who are remanded on pretrial custody. And of course, there's no limit in law to how long you can be held in pretrial custody. And those who are sentenced to terms of two years less a day. On average, those sentences are about a month. So most of the people in provincial jail are on remand, over two-thirds. And the reason that they are remanded, the reason they cannot get bail, unlike in the U.S., we don't have a cash bail system. It's usually based on having a surety, someone who can assure that you will be looked after. And quite simply, these women do not have people who will look after them. They are extremely marginalized. In terms of the experience of criminalization, you know, in my work, I'm a clinician, so it's regardless of, it has really no bearing, no concern with what people have been charged or convicted with. That said, people who are in federal prison, yes, the majority have been convicted of violent offenses. That needs to be understood in the context of their lives. There is quite a lot of response to gendered violence encompassed in that violence. There's also a great deal of fraud and drug trafficking would be the major categories. Now, that said, in Canada, the selling of sex was decriminalized in 2013, and marijuana was completely decriminalized across the country in 2018. Now, what else did you ask in that question? I think something that really...
The demographics. Let's talk about, the demographics and how many women have children, dependent children.
So there's never been a study to count the children. We are in the process of conducting two studies that bear some evidence for this question. One of those studies is in partnership with Statistics Canada, funded by the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, with my partner in this research, Dr. Fiona Kiyumjin at McMaster University. And so we're looking, kind of comparing a correctional database within the provincial system with vital statistics and birth records. We see there about not quite two-thirds of the women have children. However, I'm also conducting a point-in-time survey, also in several provincial jurisdictions, that shows about 90% of the mothers have children. So we're really just beginning to collect this data. The data collection within the prison system is extremely poor, especially with respect to reproductive health outcomes. There's absolutely no data collection or reporting about, for instance, how many people are pregnant or how many people give birth. One important demographic issue that needs to be recognized in any conversation about the carceral system in Canada is the hyper-incarceration of Indigenous people and the especially hyper-incarceration of Indigenous women. Indigenous people make up 4% of the Canadian population, and yet over 50% of the women in prison in the federal system are Indigenous. Within the provincial system, it varies from about a quarter to almost over 90 in some of the prairie provinces. So what we see there is this reincarnation of the residential school, a genocidal regime in Canadian history has been reincarnated into the prison system. And to accompany that, we also see this just explosion of Indigenous representation in the foster care system. So we have all the parents in prison, and over 50% of the children in foster care in Canada are Indigenous. Canada has really been very behind the times in terms of collecting disaggregated data by race. And so we really cannot comment concretely about the overrepresentation of Black, Brown, and people of color and newcomers to Canada, although we do see it very plain as day when we are in those institutions.
Yeah, thank you for that description. Very, very helpful. I also have this image of Canada, the expanse of Canada, and the fact that there are only six prisons. People must end up very far from where they call home.
Absolutely. And, you know, the six prisons, that was an expansion that happened around the year 2000 in response to a report that demanded a development of what was called a regional cottage system. Prior to 1996, the only prison for women was the Kingston Prison for Women in Kingston, Ontario, kind of in the center of the country. So there was just one. Canada is the second largest landmass in the world. So this presented extraordinary challenges for women to see their children ever. And the regional cottage system was a response to that, and coupled with that, the Creating Choices report also recommended the mother-child program be created that would allow children to live with their mothers in each of these six facilities.
Great. Well, let's move into discussing those mother-child programs, since that is the heart of what we're investigating in the prison nursery project of the Children of Incarcerated Caregivers. So could you just describe those programs and how do they look in general and across regions, and give us a sense of what they're intended to do and how they actually operate?
So the Institutional Mother-Child Program is one program for the entire federal system. So it's one program across these six institutions. Now, on the ground, it can look slightly different. In some places, it really only is possible for people in minimum security, although according to the commissioner's directive, the policy governing this program, you can be in medium or minimum security. Each one of these federal prisons is max, medium, and minimum, with the exception of Okima-Ochee, a healing house in Saskatchewan. The idea behind the mother-child program, the requirements have changed a bit over time, but in general, you can have your child live with you until they are age four or until they are school age. And after that, until they are six, they can live with you part-time, so come on the weekends. In addition to you needing to be classified as medium or minimum and to have no offenses against a child in your history, you also have to meet two other complicated requirements. One is that you have someone in the community in which the prison is located who can be an emergency contact person and come and get the baby and take custody of it within half an hour. So again, there are six prisons for women. The chances that you have somebody who is this close to you living in one of these communities is next to none. The other requirement is that you have somebody inside the prison who also meets the same requirements as you, no harm, no offenses against a child, minimum security, et cetera, who is willing to be your babysitter, because the prison, the mother-child program is not a prison nursery. It just means that you are allowed to keep your baby with you in your cell. There's no group, there's no early childhood education, there's no nurse, there's no real actual program. So if you need to do something, such as go to a program, go to AA, and your baby is not allowed with you, which of course they wouldn't be if there was anyone who didn't have the same security classification, then you would need a babysitter who would be willing to take care of your kid. And you would be dependent on this person. So should anything happen to this person, for instance, should they be paroled, you can no longer participate in the program. So you're very dependent on people inside and outside. The other thing is that the provincial Child Protection Services Department, so the prisons are federal, but the provinces govern child welfare, that office needs to approve your participation. And that is the greatest stumbling block, because very few child protection workers are willing to classify a prison as a safe environment for a child. So very, very few people are approved. In the past 20 years, there have been about 150 people in total ever participating in this program, even for a single day. The other thing about the program is that it's sort of about your status. It's not actually a program. You are flagged as a participant when you are flagged. And that could be when you're 4 months pregnant. And then when the baby's actually born, the baby doesn't live with you. And it looks like you participated in the program for 5 months. So the data collection and our auditing capacity about this program is extremely compromised.
Yeah, what a burden is placed on the mother to provide all these circumstances and have a level of trust in people who are there to take care of the child when they're not there. It's just no wonder that it's difficult for no wonder there are low numbers in the program, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
It's really something. So you have studied though some of the results. I mean, there's this expectation, I think, that mother-child programs were for the benefit of the child, but also they were going to, reduce recidivism and all sorts of expectations that this is going to have positive impacts on both the baby and the mother. So what have you seen in your studies of these mother-child programs?
Well, I just want to clarify that no data is collected about by the institutions about either maternal or child outcomes. So we don't know if the children are meeting their public health recommended vaccination schedules. We don't know if they're meeting developmental milestones. We don't know how many times a year they go to the ER. We don't know if they have a family doctor. We don't know if they end up going to preschool. We don't know if they have any attachment or other psychological mental health disorders. We're not tracking them long term to see what their criminalization is or their school outcomes, et cetera, et cetera. Now, from the maternal side, we're not keeping track of what happens to these pregnancies. Are they receiving adequate prenatal care? Are they making it to their appointments? Are they well, or do they have serious complications? We don't know anything about that. We also don't know if the children who participate in this program end up with their families in the long term. Because participation in this program involves opening a child protection file, you then become on Child Protection's radar, which can just jeopardize your custody of your existing children, prior children. It can also jeopardize your long-term custody of that child because you are under the gaze of a very conservative, a conservative gaze. So my work really has focused on trying to understand just what the women experienced. And part of that, for instance, was trying to get you through freedom of information, just trying to get whatever numbers are available and whatever data is available in relation to that. So, for instance, there are Indigenous, non-Indigenous flags associated with that data. And over the past 20 years, my research has shown that just over 30% of participants were Indigenous. And just keep in mind, again, that over 50% of women
Right, a much lower percentage than the actual percentage of women, right.
Now, the other thing is more of this qualitative picture, which my conversations with women have revealed. And so sort of being able to capture that incredible angst they feel associated with the precarity and the dependence that you were just describing, that this, of course, they love being with their babies. Of course, that is not, up for any discussion whatsoever. But there is competition between the haves and the have-nots because the vast majority of mothers are have-nots. Very few women get to participate in this, maybe one at a time per institution per year. My research found an average of 7 per year. So, if you're a have-not, jealousy and perhaps even sabotaging. The mother who is a have can come into the picture. And, you know, it's extremely understandable, the grief and trauma that the women who are separated from their children fear or feel, for that matter.
But even for the mothers who do have children in prison, there's no childcare, daycare. They're with the baby 24/7, except for when they can hand them off to one person they've designated in the prison with them.
Exactly. And more so, they also do not have support with some of the things that would be considered pretty basic. So if you're going to one of these six prisons, it's likely not your home community. You're going to need to find a primary care provider for your child, because the prison does not assume any responsibility for the child's welfare, other than if there was an emergency, they would call 911. But other than that, you, as a mother who has to pay for every single phone call she makes, who has no access to the internet to look things up, and who is not necessarily, and very unlikely to be, from that community, you have to figure this stuff out. If you want to apply for a temporary absence so that you can go to some type of parenting class or event in the community, how would you find out about that? The primary care thing is quite serious. How are you supposed to get your child in for their vaccines if you do not have a primary care provider in the community, and if you have no way of figuring out one? And also, 6 million Canadians do not have a primary care provider.
And if you don't get vaccines, do you lose your ability to be in the program, right?
Well, you've certainly failed your responsibilities in the eyes of Child Protection Services. So that could be something. And definitely we encountered women who were able to have their babies in the program, but upon being paroled, were unable to find things they needed for their children. Primary care, a halfway house that would take the baby, even just some way to get affordable diapers or formula. So without any support in making these arrangements, you can't make them, and you therefore fail in the eyes of child protection. You are negligent.
So there are these advocates, right? The Elizabeth Fry Group, which is an organization that provides some volunteer assistance, but do they help at all?
Yes. Well, the Elizabeth Fry Society is an advocacy organization for women in general, and who are women and gender diverse people. And they have very different, they're independent offices across the country, and they have very different roles. Their predominant role is to monitor the conditions of confinement for the prisons. So they have advocates from the central office that go in and look and see and report to the ombudsperson about acute mistreatment. So when you're focused on the fact that, for instance, somebody has been held in solitary confinement for 1500 days and is in desperate physical and mental state, you don't really have the time or space or energy or wherewithal to be advocating for somebody to get to take their kid to preschool. Like, the stakes are just really not comparable. Certainly, Elizabeth Fry societies do advocacy in relation to parenting here and there, but they really have to focus on the most acute needs: housing, legal support. Yeah. So there are, for instance, there's the Elizabeth Fry Society in Greater Vancouver has housing that does offer space for children. So you can graduate from the mother-child program at the Fraser Valley Institution in Abbotsford, BC, and go to their housing in Vancouver. So that's great for, you know, the one or two people across the country that qualify and are able to do that. But relying on community organizations to somehow counteract the ill effects of this federal policy is just really, it's not adequate.
Interesting. So maybe we could talk briefly about alternatives. What, are there any alternatives to this prison nursery model?
Well, I always come back to, you know, the second rule in the Bangkok rules, the United Nations minimum standards for the treatment of women prisoners, which says that accommodation must be made for primary caregivers' responsibilities. And that should include potentially non-custodial responses. What are we accomplishing by putting babies in prison as opposed to placing their mothers in community? Within the Federal Corrections and Conditional Release Act in Canada, there are provisions that would allow for non-custodial approaches, in particular and especially for Indigenous women. So these are vastly underused. We just have this impulsivity towards punishment. And because there is no data, because we have no evidence, we just don't seem to imagine there can be ill effect. But whenever you do something, certainly as a healthcare provider, whenever you recommend an intervention, you have to know what are the positives and what are the negatives. What's the cost? What's the benefit? What's the pro? What's the con? And we don't know these things. We're just making assumptions that it's better to put babies in prison than to put their mothers in community. But we don't have any evidence to prove that.
Right. And your suggestion is that there's almost no data that would allow you to have that evaluation.
No, absolutely not. We would have to start basically a randomized control trial and see what happens along many different axes. You know, the ones that I care about are maternal and neonatal outcomes, but somebody else probably cares about recidivism. And so on and so forth, educational outcomes, long-term, etc. So not to mention costs, right? It costs a fortune to incarcerate a baby inside a federal prison.
Do they have separate units?
It depends. So for instance, in the Nova Institution in Nova Scotia, where I did most of certainly my volunteer work and later did some, have continued to have a relationship through a research orientation. So in that institution, there is a minimum house, which looks like a low-rise apartment building, and it's outside of the gates of the main prison. And it's within that minimum house and only within that minimum house that applicants to the mother-child program can be housed. So if you are not minimum security, you do not get to participate in the mother-child program. Within that building, there's sort of like a little antechamber to the cell for each person to have a crib. And there's also sort of a main kitchen area for four different cells to share and a little living space, like with a mat and some toys. There's no green space. There's no playground.
And up to how old would a child be allowed to live in that setting?
Well, in theory, like I said, until they're four. But what I've found in my observations, I haven't been able to run data to prove this, but what I have found is that it's only really people who have their babies in prison who get to participate in the program. So you have to be pregnant to be noticed, to be told about the mother-child program, and then apply and get to participate. People who, for instance, have a six-month-old baby, who very well could stay with them until the baby's four, are not really flagged as mothers. It's that pregnancy that is this visible cue to alert staff that the person should be informed about the mother-child program, or even other prisoners alerting that person to the existence of this program and the application process. So without that visible marker, motherhood and the angst and harm and postpartum depression and trauma of separation, that is just sort of invisibilized for most of the women, right?
Right. And the application process, as you suggested, is incredibly onerous. And so all of those things mixed together, and unless someone is guiding you through the process, it feels like it's almost impossible.
Well, and you don't lead the process. You're dependent on Child Protection Services, a provincial department, to do their assessment. And the timeliness of that assessment has to line up with your birth schedule. The chances of that happening are very slim. So if they haven't finished their assessment and the baby's born, the baby will be sent to foster care while we're waiting for the result. And then, of course, it's very difficult to get a child out of foster care once that process has been started. So it's these levels of dependence that really are very profoundly disempowering and also very inefficient.
So tell me, Martha, what is the internal debate in Canada on this? Are there particular actors who are taking sides? Is the government invested now in this concept of mother-child programs because they've established the program and they think it's the right way to go? Or I mean, whose voices are being represented in the national discussion about this?
Well, the Senate of Canada recently released a report calling for more participation in the mother-child program and recognizing the eligibility criteria are too strict. Now, has that resulted in any change? No, it has not. The Elizabeth Fry Societies are an abolitionist organization and disagree with increasing investment in this program. However, they also are gender responsive and recognize that a lot of women want to get to participate through a more open process. So there's a little bit of conflict there, but I think what is missing from that is, you know, it's not that Elizabeth Fry Societies or any abolitionist, including myself, are advocating for women not to get to be with their babies. The alternative to the mother-child program is to have the mother and child in community. And that very obvious alternative seems to be just totally absent from the imagination of any government or ministerial actor.
And are we hearing from the voices of the formerly incarcerated women about what their experience has been and what they would suggest?
Well, I have published about this, but really there isn't really any other platform where these women's voices are being broadcast. There's very few participants, right? Like a handful of participants who have survived incarceration, the chances of them becoming public vocal advocates are just really, really slim. It's really demanding much too much of a tiny, tiny number of people who, once they finally get out from there, just want to put it behind them.
Right. Well, this is such an interesting picture, as you say, when you compare it to your neighbor south of the border, where we have this mass incarceration and there are enormous numbers of women in state and federal prison. It is a small group over a large land mass, but there are many of the same problems that we see systemically across these places. And I think some of your work addresses the impacts of race, class, and gender on this whole family experience, and it's very insightful into the issue in an international perspective. So let me just invite you, if there's any last considerations you want us to make sure that we get out in this discussion, I'd be delighted to hear from you.
Thank you. I just really appreciate this opportunity to continue to raise questions about this program. We really need to think critically about these types of investments, and that critical thought is simply not happening. And these children who either don't get to participate or do get to participate, their experiences are totally invisible. And so there are so many different dimensions of experience that need to be considered in an evaluation of the impact of this program. and it simply has not yet been a priority. So it's something that just we need to keep demanding attention to the experiences of these prisoners and their children.
Well, Dr. Martha Painter, it's been a complete pleasure to have this discussion, and we're so pleased to know about your work, and we'll continue in communication. Dr. Painter, again, is the Director of Nursing Research with the Contraception and Abortion Research Team at the University of British Columbia and Assistant Professor in the Faculty of Nursing at the University of New Brunswick. She has published broadly on these topics, and we are really indebted to her critical eye. So I want to thank you all for listening to the Children of Incarcerated Caregivers International Prison Nursery podcast. I'm your host, Barbara Fry, an advisory board member of Children of Incarcerated Caregivers. To learn more about our organization and to view additional materials, documents, and research from this episode, you can visit our website at cicmn.org. That's cicmn.org. This episode was recorded in April 2024 in collaboration with the University of Minnesota's Human Rights Program and with research by Carly Mossbrook Addy, Sharon Izuara, Ashley Gustafson, and Olivia Hudson. Episodes contain original music by David Smith and production by Brian Carnell. Don't forget to tune into the next episode. We hope to see you there.